Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for July 19th, 2009. I'm your host, Command Line, the self-proclaimed hacker, curmudgeon, and hacktivist, and this is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing from over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of society and politics with technology, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a newscast. In it, a new free and open source software law journal launches, updating the Linux kernel without any downtime, a critical security flaw is uncovered in the brand new version of Firefox, and thankfully already patched, and more details come to light on the new business model for the Pirate Bay website. All of this and more. First, though, I wanted to give you another update, a weekly update, on the progress of the Podio book project in particular. This ends my third week of doing the audio production work for reserializing the original inner chapters audio from the podcast. As I've explained before, this work involves some new fore and after matter music and minimal editing to clean up that archival audio. Many listeners are actually new to the podcast, and while they enjoy the current installments of the inner chapters, haven't heard many of the earliest shows. I tend to keep my RSS feeds to about a year's worth, maybe a little bit more, archival episodes of the show, so it's harder often to go back to those earliest episodes. This is a really nice convenience for folks who want to be able to get at that audio in an easy prepackaged form. If you're not familiar with what podiobooks.com does and the general concept of a Podio book, is it allows you to listen to an audio work on your own schedule. So I, as the producer, produce all of that, upload it, mark it up, do all of the necessary production work. You can come along at any time, subscribe when you want, start listening when you want, and even set your own release schedule. You can release the entirety of a work, you can release it daily, weekly, monthly, whatever you like. And that's not just true of the Podio book I'm producing. There are hundreds, if not thousands by now, titles already up at podiobooks.com of all genres and stripes that you might enjoy that have that same exact feature set of being able to listen on your own schedule. Really cool stuff. I've also had some questions in the past week about how listeners can help out with the Podio Books project in particular. And as it turns out, actually, there's only one small thing you might be able to help me with, and that's in writing and producing the audio promo for the Podio Book itself. So suggestions of qualities that I might want to speak to in that promo, draft scripts, if you want to go that far. I hate doing that kind of self-promotional writing. So it's some of the hardest writing that I have to do for the podcast, for myself as a speaker, and the like. So any help there, just even in the form of ideas, would be much appreciated. Otherwise, it's very difficult for me to actually distribute out any of the work on the Podio book because it's almost entirely audio editing. And that's something I'm well prepared to do. At this point, six episodes in, I think I've established a pretty good velocity at doing that. I think I can maintain two episodes a week, which is the goal I set out with. The first couple of weeks were rough because of the initial work I had to do in finding, locating, and chopping up the music to go along with this, to do some minimal writing and re-recording of intros and outros and the like. But I was able to do two episodes in less than 2 hours yesterday. And even though the segment length varies from 15 to 30 minutes from interchapter to interchapter, I think that 2 hour upper limit should hold true through the course of the first 12 episode, first volume of the interchapters. I have enough material to put out three more volumes at that same chapter count, so we'll see how it goes. As it stands, I have the minimum number of episodes required to actually schedule a release of the Podio book, but there's some technical issues holding me up here, and I'm working through those with some of the fine folks at podiobooks.com. There seems to be a snafu with the fact that they use Libsyn for their media hosting. Libsyn actually has a pro service that podiobooks.com uses, and I have an ancient four-year-old Libsyn account, and there seems to be some sort of disconnect with them allowing me to reuse my pre-existing account in order to access the pro site where Patio Books uploads and manages new titles. So as soon as we get that sorted, then I'll be able to upload all of the episodes I have and hopefully schedule a release very quickly on the heels of that. Stay tuned to the podcast and to the website for news on when that date will be. Like many of you, I have a home network and several systems to secure, so I follow reports of security vulnerabilities with special interest. Each week, I pick a couple of those to talk about here, both to cement them in my mind and to raise some awareness. I only had one security story I wanted to talk about this week, and that's news that the brand new release of Firefox, that's 3.5, that dropped just a few weeks ago, had a very critical security vulnerability exposed to it in the last week. Actually, this was discovered 2 weeks ago. It was just disclosed by Mozilla up at their security blog. That's the primary link I have to this. What this turns out to be is a bug in Mozilla's JIT compiler for JavaScript, and it's specific to the rewritten JavaScript engine in 3.5. So thankfully, this problem does not affect earlier versions of Firefox. This can be simply exploited by merely viewing a page with attacking code. And I've got a link to ZDNet's zero-day blog for details on the exploit code. It was posted to the site Millworm. And the fact that there is exploit code in the wild and available on this site probably explains the quick response both in disclosing the nature and details of this bug from Mozilla itself, but also to the second half of the story, which I'll get to in a moment, the fact that they have already fixed this so rapidly. For this exploit to work, you do actually have to view a malicious website, so it involves some social engineering as well as the technical details of the attack, but it does allow an attacker, once they get you to view that site, to execute arbitrary code on your system. It can be mitigated, as the Mozilla security post points out, by disabling the JIT compiler, and they have good detailed instructions for how to do so. At the time of Mozilla's announcement around midweek, they were already working on a fix and only recommended disabling the JIT compiler for JavaScript as a temporary workaround. The downside of doing so, as they point out, is that it would slow down any pages or applications that make very heavy or intense use of JavaScript. As I said, the good news here is that at the time of this recording, Mozilla has already released a point release, 3.5.1, to their automated update channel that closes this vulnerability completely. Actually, according to the comments on the original Mozilla post, they had a fix apparently by midweek already in the 3.6 nightly builds. Those are the development versions working towards the next major release of the browser. So odds are all they had to do here was to backport those fixes to the 3.5 code base and test in order to get this patch out so quickly. If you have the automated updates turned on, which you should, I think it's on by default in Firefox, then you will have already received this point update that not only closes this critical security hole, but also, according to the register piece that I picked for the details of the patch, also fixes a performance problem on startup of the browser for Windows users. If you saw the workaround before I talked about on this show, don't forget to go back into About Config and re-enable your JIT compiler for JavaScript. It's no longer necessary to have that disabled. You can check the under the Help menu on most systems, under the App menu on OS X for the version information about the browser to make sure that you are, in fact, running 3.5.1 if you have any question. And as always, this is another ringing endorsement both for the speed and transparency with which open source projects like Firefox and Mozilla can respond to these sorts of issues, but the power of a very usable and easy automated update channel to get patches like this distributed very, very quickly. Here are the news that caught my eye this week. For more, check out the website, thecommandline.net. The first story I wanted to talk about was an announcement that Corey picked up on Boing Boing of a new free and open source software law journal, a peer-reviewed one that launched this past week. It's by name the International Free and Open Source Software Law Review. In the post, I think Corey really has it right that this is a positive sign that lawyers are taking the licenses that drive free software and open source software quite seriously. There are still many questions around their interpretation and how the conditions and covenants of these licenses are actually enforced. Are they, even their very nature, so are they merely conditions on a copyright like the GPL very much attests, or are they contracts with acceptance and consideration like traditional commercial contracts, or are they possibly some hybridization of both of these? I'm still finishing the book Open Source Licensing by Lawrence Rosen, and I'll include a link to that in the show notes. That book is now 5 years old, but it marks out part of a small but growing trend of lawyers and legal scholars considering the ramifications and the practical issues of open source licenses for hackers, developers, and even commercial outfits. Rosen in particular makes this material very accessible, and where he does criticize some of the approaches of different licenses, he always manages in the book to be quite constructive about doing so. He's definitely an advocate, so he's very much in favor of open source and free software license, and in doing so also fulfilling one of the critical roles I think an advocate has to take on, that of trying to improve public understanding of the issues. As it turns out, I didn't realize this when I wrote the intro to talk about this story, Rosen is actually one of the contributors to this new journal, to the inaugural issue. If you look at the table of contents, you'll see one of the articles with his name by it. There is actually already a similar journal that was brought to my attention, but more for open content and issues of transformative and derivative works and copyright, not specifically for public licensing in software. That is the Journal of Transformative Works and Cultures. So this is a vein that other people are tapping. I take these, as I said, to be the burgeoning beginnings of a trend in interest beyond just the bleeding edge IP law geeks and open source and free software geeks. Reading the editor's introduction to this inaugural issue actually very much reinforces that the purpose of this new journal is to deal much more with practical matters. It actually reminds me quite a bit of Bankler's work in economics and network theory. And not surprisingly, that introduction quotes Stuart Brand, the source of the infamous information wants to be free quote. It's very often misquoted, misunderstood. I encourage you at a minimum to read that introduction for how they tie in Brand's thoughts into free software and open source software. I'd say you probably need to be a lawyer or a law geek to really get the most out of reading this, but the fact that Rosen is one of the contributors means that article by article, some of them may be more accessible than others. You can definitely recommend it to any lawyers that you know, especially if you're an engineer or a programmer by profession, to the counsel in your organization. If they have to deal with navigating the conditions that they have to deal with, enforcement issues with open source and free software, you can read, or they can read, entire issues online or download PDFs of some. The articles are released under a Creative Commons license, and you can share and redistribute the ones that you're interested in. You just have to be sure that you attribute the source and the author, and that you don't change the articles. They use a no derivatives condition. You can also register, as I did, for announcements by email when new issues come out, so you can keep up with what I hope is the start of a very long-term project to really help make sense of and make accessible all of this great information. I always find the most thought-provoking pieces on O'Reilly's Radar site, which is very much its mandate to look out for things on the horizon and bring them to our attention. This time it was an Ignite talk. Ignite talks are only 5 minutes long with auto-timed slides that display along with that to enforce the brevity of the presentation. The one in particular that was called out by the Radar author here was given by Greg Ellen, who has worked previously with the Sunlight Foundation, one of the NGOs here in the DC area. The Sunlight Foundation has worked on issues of data transparency in government, most notably, and has worked on online applications and mashups to try to scrape, parse, and filter online information from the government, make that more accessible, do some trends and analysis on that. He's definitely interested in issues of technology and public policy, given that background. And I actually had the very good fortune to meet Greg Allen in person at the launch of the Open Technology Initiative recently, some weeks back at the New America Foundation, another progressive NGO here in the DC area. In this talk, he does a good job of explaining how agencies in the government work to those outside of DC. I take it very much for granted that the goings-on in federal government are part of our daily news here for those of us who live in and around the nation's capital. He characterizes these agencies as large, non-functioning companies. So he relates them to what developers in the private sector, professional hackers, might already be familiar with. An example of that bureaucracy, he shows a flowchart for a purchasing procedure in one of the various defense agencies. And he actually goes on to compare lawmaking to another activity with which hackers may be familiar, that of patching source code. And he has a good example in one of his slides of how amendments strike, insert, and append to the text of existing laws, much in the same way that software patches do that to the text of source code. Not surprisingly, he does describe government as a legacy system, though, and gives it credit, despite that, with being good at sharing information, just not in the form we might like. And in that way, the implication is very clear that it's very much like technological legacy systems that we need bridges and adapters and things like that in order to make them useful with our current expectations about how to leverage information, knowledge, and tools. He thinks we actually can build on top of existing IT and government, like the Thomas system he mentions in the talk. This is a system for publishing the text of laws, and he's actually very optimistic about new initiatives moving forward to do this. He talks about the 70 or more sites up on recovery.gov of agencies and others publishing information about recovery programs in the government. He has this great quote that I've pulled out. He talks about recovery is a $70 billion hashtag. So that's a very interesting sort of mashup between the scales of spending in the government and the social media space. He also points out where hacktivists have already improved upon government systems, making them more accessible, more familiar, more approachable. The examples are out there, is the point of his speech. What we really need is to build on that momentum and put more of them out. The implication is the more we pull on these legacy systems, the more important transparency becomes, and the quicker we end up ditching dead processes, old out-of-date processes like printing and rescanning and printing and rescanning that still goes on in many corners of the federal government. There is much to be hopeful about, as the general overall tone of his talk is quite optimistic. But being local to DC, again, from my perspective, I know we realistically have a very long way to go here. Ellen is right. Now, though, is an excellent time to get involved. There are a lot of good opportunities, and I encourage you to watch the entirety of Ellen's speech to very much get a flavor of how you can participate in this sort of interesting marriage between hacking and government. From the very deeply wonky to the very deeply technical geeky, my next story is a brilliant Ars piece about a nice bit of Linux kernel hackery. This is the proposition that a new player could make it possible to update a running Linux kernel with literal or no downtime. It's a great article by Ryan Paul at Ars Technica. Many Linux admins obsess over uptime. It's not unusual to get a Linux system to run continuously, except for when you actually have to update the kernel itself. That almost invariably involves power cycling the box or doing a soft reboot to get that running. So this company, K-Splice, is working on a way of doing no downtime updates to the kernel itself, as I said at the outset. According to the article, two things make this possible. The first is the fact that the Linux kernel is fully open source and hence totally available for analysis. The second is capabilities in the GCC compiler suite, in particular the C compiler, which enable production and comparison of compiled object code. New functions can be written into memory on the basis of these comparisons and analysis to replace existing ones in the running kernel. This results in a minimal 0.7 millisecond downtime, according to the technical paper linked through to by the RSPs. This is probably just a result of the physical memory management system, the computer having to lock for just a moment as that memory region is being rewritten with the new function definition. All throughout this update, though, the article notes, the kernel remains operational and intact. It works best where pure decision logic changes, not any of the data type definitions or structures in the effective code. According to the researchers, this is actually true of most security patches. It's also possible, again, according to the technical paper, to apply patches that actually do change the data structures and symbols in the running kernel, but that requires a bit more effort. All of it, from the simpler changes to just functional code through to the more involved, requires a special kernel module to be running. The company behind the research is already offering a service to support these efforts. They have one that's free for use to update running Ubuntu systems in particular. I can't tell if this is free software. There's no real licensing information up at the K-Splice website. I have to imagine, given that most of the material up there, and actually even in the RS piece, talks about the service offering from these folks, that it is not free software. If it was, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe somebody who's on the kernel mailing list knows whether patches have been submitted to add this as just an ordinary feature in the kernel itself. You can get support for other distributions other than Ubuntu. They seem to be committed to supporting that for free indefinitely, but they also apparently are offering services and support for other distributions. The impression I get is that they want to sell this as a service, and this is not maybe a bad model to compromise, to build on top of free software, to have this sort of value add, especially for companies that require this high availability and uptime. It makes a certain amount of sense, since it's really overkill to use something like this for a desktop operating system where the dozens of seconds up to a minute it takes to reboot a typical modern piece of hardware running Ubuntu is very minimally disruptive for your average consumer. But for somebody trying to run a 4 and 5 9 shop, the advantage for an offering like K-Splice is pretty darn obvious. I don't have a lot of details around this last story, except to suggest that I think it's a part of a larger series of problems that I've already talked about with Amazon's Kindle ebook reader. And that's news that Amazon has remotely deleted customers' purchases this past week. I have a link to the New York Times Bits blog. There's a very brief piece on this. They actually don't even mention at the time that they wrote that the author in question of these works is Orwell. People have been making a lot of hay out of that. The Ars Technica coverage of this, which I've also linked to, actually has an introduction that's lousy with Orwell references. If you can withstand that, there's some good additional detail up at Ars Technica. There's an update on the Bits piece, though, that does clarify that the additions that they did remove were unauthorized additions. More on that in a moment. Amazon promises it will only remove books from its store in the future, not actually removing them from remote devices as they did in this case. And they did at least credit the users' accounts who were affected by this. The problem, though, is this establishes a pattern of Amazon caving in to publishers. It's not an isolated data point. I would say at this point, this is very much a trend of Amazon's behavior with regards to the rights holders. Worse, as has been noted by many before, we don't know all of the various remote control options. Now we know a few of them, but what else do we not know? We know that text-to-speech has been disabled, books have been removed from the remote device, but what else might Amazon do on behalf of the publisher and at the expense of the consumer? The Bits piece actually puts its finger, I think, on the most important problem here, that consumers have an expectation of ownership, regardless of the fact that these electronic books are wholly digital. But Amazon is making it obvious by their actions that all the users have actually purchased is a license to those works, and a revocable license at that. Ken Fisher at Ars Technica gets very much to the bottom of this. Amazon was actually reselling an electronic edition from a third-party provider, Mobile Reference, that ordinarily packages public domain works. The problem here is the titles in question, some of the ones from George Orwell, are not yet in the public domain. So as the Bits correction states, Amazon actually yanked infringing copies, so they arguably acted legally, at least, in the right on this. Amazon is further claiming that a third party actually added these titles to its Kindle service, so they're trying to disclaim, I guess, some of the responsibility for these getting out there in the first place. The article also notes that these titles are no longer available on the Mobile Reference site either. They haven't just been taken down from Amazon. And the Ars piece also points out to what they believe to be a particularly salient point in the terms of service for the Kindle. They focus on the emphasis on a permanent copy, and some analysts are trying to make some hay out of this, that Amazon has actually violated its own terms of service in terms of the consideration to the customer. I actually see the final sentence of the block they quoted as being of interest, that it really is reinforcing that it's still only a license, not you're not buying the work outright. Amazon, once again, is claiming their IT system is more autonomous than them. That is, that the removals were done automatically without any kind of intervention. You'd think someone at Amazon at this point would start thinking about this, that they've had several of their systems that they're claiming have these automated behaviors that have caused PR nightmares, that they would change their systems over to have fail-safes when these things happen, that really require some human intervention, rather than having this scenario. I have this kind of crazy, humorous picture in my head of Amazon's computers kind of running amok in their data center, deleting works from Kindle devices and deleting reviews on websites and things that, after the fact, Amazon saying, no, we didn't want that to happen at all. Like I said, it's part of a larger trend with Amazon that's laughable if the costs to the consumer weren't so unfortunate. Some of the stories that catch my attention during the week are actually continuations of stories or themes that I've talked about before, and I like to set aside a little extra time to go over those and follow up. I've talked repeatedly about the device maker Neuros, from their open devices like the Link and the OSD that are built with open hardware specs and an open software stack with bounties even for third-party contributions into this open source ecosystem they're trying to build up, to their unlocked branding that I've talked about, a service mark freely available for others to use. I'll include a link to that program in particular in the show notes if you're not familiar with it. Corey has a demo video that he's embedded up in a post on Boing Boing of the current release of the Lynx software stack. And judging by the video, it's very well polished at this point and very much comparable to a lot of other projects like Boxy that we've seen targeted at living room television navigation. And it's not surprising, since apparently the core UI of the Link is actually based on XBMC, which Boxy is as well. You can discover and integrate popular online media sources as well as anything you're able to serve off of your local network. In particular, they call out Hulu. It's an increasingly popular video service despite some of the issues with takedown of some video that Hulu's had in past months. It's also worth noting that it actually can also run Boxy side by side with its own UI. The Link is not the original device that Neuros put out. It actually only launched 7 months ago, and unlike the OSD, the first device that they actually put out, it does output HD video and provides an HDMI connector. The OSD, by comparison, is much more a capture device and is limited in only being able to do so through analog systems. And that's because, whether you know it or not, the HDMI and your great new high-definition digital set has DRM built right in, and Neuros had to work around that by only supporting analog on the capture side, even though for playback they can support, you know, high-definition, very glorious video. The Link is still at this time in pre-production, what they're referring to as a gamma stage, but it looks like it's getting very close to ready, judging by this video. So hopefully we will see finished versions of the link available in the market soon and will be a very viable option, especially if they support some of the forthcoming interconnect specs that are in discussion for sharing media in a home environment. The other story I'm following up on is the business model that is emerging closer to practice around the Pirate Bay website after its sale to GGF. Mike Masnick up at TechDirt has the details, and according to the piece there, it's not as rosy as it was originally depicted in the initial press around the sale. Leechers on the BitTorrent services will actually have to pay in. It's not a everybody who participates gets paid, as was the initial implication. Now, the more you seed, to be fair, the more you contribute back, the less you'll have to pay. And I at the upper end, it's suggested that you may earn some money back if your seed ratio is high enough. Also, apparently not all the ISPs that they're targeting will actually pay into the system, just some of them. It doesn't look like it will be a requirement or even as central as originally portrayed. Masnick really points out the two problems with information as it's emerging on what GGF is planning to do. First, that requiring payment of any kind for any fractions of users will result in many just outright abandoning the services, especially if there are still pirate services that are freely available. And if you've read the Darknet paper, you know there's always going to be a Darknet freely available. And the other problem is that they are essentially pushing the cost actually onto the flat rate residential ISPs. They're making money off of willing users who have something like a high-end fiber connection. GGF is also positioning this as really just a storage or a bandwidth play and downplaying any sort of the content elements. It's not really clear from the new details that the licensing deals, again, are as central as they made them out initially. I think it's pretty clear that the spirit of the original Pirate Bay site is gone at this point. The new site might be successful in some ways, even with this kind of odd business model that's being revealed, but it's never going to be the same. The original site is gone, and all we can do is, as we have in the past when this has happened, is look to its moral and logical successors. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoy the program, please go to the website at thecommandline.net, make a donation, purchase some swag, or at the very least, tell a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're also welcome to post those on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. The next show, which should go out in the feed Wednesday night as usual, will be a new Hacking 101 on the question of how to contribute to open source projects. Until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Libsyn and Waha2B for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits, and permissions to use those are granted under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial ShareAlike version 3.0 United States license.